Politics Wednesday is once again upon us. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Joining us today, Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
Also, Chris Larimer with us in our Cedar Falls studio, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Good to have you back, Chris.
Good to be here, Ben.
Before we get to the primary results, we want to have your thoughts on the primary results from yesterday. I wanted to ask Tim Hagel, because, Tim, you are a lawyer. You have a law degree in addition to your political science background. And we just heard in the top of the hour's news the sweeping decision in favor of digital privacy, the Supreme Court ruling today. We heard in our news that police almost always need a warrant to search a person's cell phone, even in the case of someone placed under arrest, a unanimous decision. And it's against the Obama administration. The usual law is what?
Well, normally when someone is arrested, the idea is that the police can conduct a search of whatever's on the person's body, meaning clothing, pockets, backpacks, that sort of thing, without a warrant. The idea being is that you want to protect the police officer from any weapons the person may have on that on the body or within immediate grasp, which if it's a automobile stop means in the passenger compartment of the car, or if there's evidence that could be easily disposed of that relates to whatever reason the police pulled somebody over. And what the court said today, in its unanimous opinion, although Alito did partially concur in the judgment, was that there's nothing usually in a phone that would relate to that particular crime, that there may be some circumstances, and they have to look at it on a case-by-case basis as to whether there would be something important there that the police could go ahead and open up the phone and look in it. But the court was balancing those reasons against the concerns of privacy, particularly given today that people put so much personal information on their phone. It's not just a list of phone numbers or even a list of who you called, but information that could include medical information, personal information about your family, and so forth. And the court was trying to balance those two interests.
Mm-hmm. In fact, in writing the opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts said, "Modern cell phones are not just another technological convenience." In another part of the decision, he wrote, "The proverbial visitor from Mars might conclude they were an important feature of human anatomy." Who can argue with that when we look at the way we treat our cell phones and cradle them and hold them so closely for so long during our waking hours and sometimes, I guess, even our sleeping hours? What's the significance of this, Tim Hagel?
Well, as usual, law enforcement is probably not particularly happy about it because it does mean that they have to go to the trouble of occasionally getting a search warrant if they feel that there's something in the phone that might be useful to them in charging or getting evidence for a particular suspect. But on the other hand, like I said, the court was looking towards balancing the person's privacy interests and saying that it shouldn't be that much of an inconvenience. And the court did deal with the idea that, well, if there was or happened to be evidence on that phone, that it could be wiped remotely. But the court talked about that too, saying, well, police will have technological means to combat that too if, again, they really want to do it. And it shouldn't be that much trouble to go ahead and get that particular warrant.
Tim Hagel is with us along with Chris Larimer. It's Politics Wednesday. We want to talk for the next few minutes, several minutes, about the last round of multi-state primaries until August that was held yesterday. Get the takeaways from that latest round of multi-state primaries and also get insights on Iowa's congressional races now that the matchups as of this past weekend are finally completed with the 3rd district matchup now decided. A bit of a shocker there. We'll get to that in just a moment. If you'd like to join our conversation, please do on this Politics Wednesday, 1-866-780-9100. Now that those matchups are set for November's general election, what issues matter to you most in choosing who wins your vote? What are you looking for in your district to decide your vote? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Primary results outside of the state. Let's go to Mississippi. Seems to be top of the heap there as far as media attention. Voters giving 6-term Republican Senator Thad Cochran the GOP nomination. and the opportunity to face the Democratic nominee in November. Cochran faced a runoff with a Tea Party-backed challenger, State Senator Chris McDaniel, when neither met that threshold for an outright victory back on June 3rd. Celebrating victory last night, Senator Cochran thanked supporters, calling it their victory.
It's been a real pleasure working closely with so many of you, making appearances in towns all across Mississippi, being in church services with Gregory Harper, attending meetings that were important to talk about the future of our state. And what we have tonight is reflected as a consensus for more and better jobs for Mississippi workers. A military force and the capacity to defend the security interests of the United States of America. Those were our principal grounds, planks in the platform for the campaign. But you are the ones who helped reach all the voters, make sure that we knew that they were important to this election because it's a group effort, it's not a solo. And so we all have a right to be proud of our state tonight. Thank you very much. Thank you for this wonderful honor and wonderful challenge that lies ahead. Thank you very, very much.
Six-term Republican Senator Thad Cochran of Mississippi winning the GOP nomination yesterday in that primary. It's a primary vote in which Cochran openly courted Democratic voters in the race who were eligible to vote in the runoff if they had not voted in the Democratic primary. Prompting talk of a court challenge by the McDaniel campaign. I wonder, Chris Larimer, if we see this as a fair victory in that light?
I think so. I haven't seen a lot yet to suggest that there was anything that was not fair or unfair. But that's something that the challenger, Chris McDaniel, can certainly do. I think you mentioned that this was courting a different set of voters than from the June 3rd primary. You could have voters, if they did not vote in that June 3rd Democratic primary, they could show up last night and cast a vote in this runoff election, which I think is fairly unique. I haven't looked at all the other states, but that's somewhat unique and creates almost an entirely different election than what we saw 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Tim Hagel, does it matter whether Cochran's views represent the majority of Republicans in his district, if they do represent the majority of voters in both parties?
Well, that's kind of the issue is Mississippi has what's called an open primary, which means that you don't have to be registered for a particular party in order to actually vote in that party's primary, unlike Iowa, where even though we do have, of course, same-day registration, so you could switch your party registration if you chose to do so. But most people don't, and you don't have that kind of crossover vote, and you can't really appeal to voters in that same way. And on the one side, you can argue, well, if you have an open primary, it does allow more people to participate if they wish to do so. But on the other hand, the idea is that a party is supposed to select its own nominee and then you can vote in the general election. So you can sort of see both sides.
Do you get a better gauge on electability, though, perhaps?
It's possible that you can get a better gauge on that to the extent that you have people that may be unaffiliated independents, no party voters, as we call them here in Iowa, that want to participate as well. But on the other hand, then it's not the party's choice. So if you pick somebody that say, well, this is maybe somebody we'd like to see in the general election, but that's not the party's choice to do so, is it the party's choice to say, well, we would rather have somebody who's this way on the issues rather than that way on the issues? And if that person is unelectable in the general election, that's our problem, not yours. So you kind of get back and forth on these things.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add to Mississippi, Chris, before we move on?
No, I think Tim hit it. That was
okay.
Good.
In New York, another much-watched primary yesterday, longtime New York Congressman Charlie Rangel also narrowly held off a primary challenge last night. Rangel declared victory, though his opponent says he's waiting for all the votes to be counted. I think that's the last update on that. This 22-term Democrat says victory or defeat, he would say the same thing.
They think this election was historic. It shows the changes that have taken place in America. And I think it shows that we're going to have to work together if we're going to move forward together. There's no better congressional district in the country that can show what we can do when we are working together. If you take a look at this gorgeous mosaic in this room, every religion, every color, no matter where you were born, we're here together to win for our families, for our community, and for our country.
Okay, Charlie Rangel yesterday, 22-term Democrat. Do either of these victories, Chris Larimer, tell us anything broader about the picture for November's midterm elections with this latest chapter of primaries, yet now the results in the door?
I'm not sure that there's any sort of general pattern that comes out from either one. I think, you know, with the race with Charlie Rangel in New York, it was unique in that so much of the season has been focused on is there infighting within the Republican Party? Are there factions within the Republican Party? And is that why we're seeing so many challenges to these so-called establishment Republicans or these longtime incumbents? In this case, we had a challenge to a Democratic incumbent. And so, you know, within each party, you can have factions, and it sort of depends on the political winds, whether or not, you know, which side prevails. But I think, in both cases, it shows, you know, you have two long-term incumbents. You still have to be out there running. You still have to do your get-out-the-vote efforts. And, you know, in both cases, I think, you know, these two incumbents are going to be reelected quite easily, particularly in the case of Rangel.
With the GOP establishment, Tim Hagel, it's harder now to paint the GOP as with these losses, the Tea Party losses here in the primaries, as the Tea Party being ascendant, the GOP being intolerant, which the Democrats would like to paint the GOP as?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the Tea Party has had its occasional successes. And again, it's never been an official party in that sense, and how much people are or aren't. And we haven't talked about it yet, but Oklahoma is kind of an example of that, where supposedly the Tea Party challenger was the one who lost fairly convincingly to a current representative. This was a Senate race to replace Senator Tom Coburn, and current Representative Langford was the one that won fairly convincingly. But he had come to office on the wave of the Tea Party year of 2010 and somehow fell a bit somewhat out of favor. And so now the other person was seen as the Tea Party. So it's kind of a flux sort of thing. And I think particularly in the midterm elections, perhaps the general pattern you see is that it really boils down to what goes on in a particular district or state, mm-hmm. and that occasionally in midterm elections you will have some sort of unifying theme that may help to propel one party or the other. But a lot of times, especially in the midterms, you don't have that, and so it does boil down to what's going on, the particulars in a given state or district.
So when we localize it to a district and we think about the surprise and shock across the country about Eric Cantor's loss in Virginia 2 weeks ago, that doesn't seem to have the national significance that some would have said it did, huh?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly that's part of it. But the challenger, Brad, was not well-funded, did not have a lot of money, and a lot of money was spent against him, which some people say, well, maybe too much because they tried to paint him too quickly as negative, which increased his name recognition. But it was also part of the factor was that locally Cantor was not seen as paying attention to his constituents, that he apparently forgot the adage, all politics is local. It's usually associated with former Speaker Tip O'Neill. So that was a big part of why Cantor lost. He was, you know, maybe thinking too highly of himself, wasn't paying attention to his constituents.
And I think, you know, if I could add something, you know, I think in addition to what Tim said, I think obviously all of this depends on the voters. We see, you know, with the runoff election we had, there was extraordinarily high turnout in Mississippi, but then if you go to New York, the turnout was much lower than expected. You know, the GOP primary in Iowa for the Senate seat, for Harkin's seat that is retiring, you know, the primary turnout there was maybe somewhat lower than expected. But again, it depends on how well you can mobilize these voters, how enthusiastic you can get these voters about the campaign. And then to think about, you know, that Tea Party movement, if you think of sort of Sarah Palin and Ted Cruz as kind of the primary movers behind that movement, you know, they backed winners in Iowa, in Nebraska, but then, as Tim said, the candidate that they backed in Oklahoma didn't win. So, it, you know, just to kind of reinforce that point, it really is a sort of a state specific issue or even a district issue.
I asked Tim about this. Let me ask you, Chris. When you put your finger on the pulse of the Tea Party faction, what do you feel now? A strong pulse, an ascendant pulse, or something weakening?
I think. Well, I mean, the polls would suggest that it's weakening. That that people don't necessarily align with the Tea Party or don't are not necessarily as enthusiastic about the Tea Party movement. On the other hand, you know, we've certainly seen cases in many primary elections where the Tea Party candidate has really challenged the so-called establishment Republican, or the incumbent has had to answer challenges by the Tea Party or accusations by the Tea Party, and has made some races quite competitive that were initially seen as uncompetitive. So I think it's, you know, maybe right in the middle right now. I think it's hard to gauge.
Mm-hmm. With these latest results, Tim and Chris, does it change our thoughts on whether the Senate, the big question, whether the Senate is likely to stay in Democratic hands, in control?
I think it's an open question, and I'm not going to make any predictions on this.
Okay.
I will say I was watching Larry Sabatow, the runs the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, talking about their ratings for the various races. And right now, Sabatow was suggesting that they don't see any Senate seats that the Democrats have a really good chance to pick up, changing from Democrat to Republican. And on the other hand, to the extent that Republicans would need to pick up three seats to take control of the Senate, that it seems that three are sort of given, that they're going to switch from Democrat to Republican. And so that puts several other seats, including Iowa's, in competition. And so that's probably where we're going to see most of the attention and most of the action for the next several months.
Okay, well, we do want to talk about the race for the open Senate seat here in Iowa between Bruce Braley and Joni Ernst in just a moment. But first, let's put ahead of that, because just this past weekend, we found that the suspense ended the past weekend. Iowa Republicans chose a candidate in Iowa's 3rd congressional district. And even the man who won this nomination admits that he was stunned by the turn of events, I think, over the weekend in a surprise victory. 3rd District Republican delegates chose David Young as the GOP nominee for Congress. Young, a former chief of staff for Senator Chuck Grassley, seemed as surprised as anyone to get this nod.
Anything can happen. It's exhilarating. There's so many different emotions moving inside me. But right now I'm actually looking towards November and figuring out where we go from here.
Okay, David Young finishing 5th in the primary voting on June 3rd. Chris, how did he go from 5th in the primary vote to win this nomination at convention?
Well, I mean, it depends. You know, it was a function of how the convention works and how the different rounds of voting work. I did not attend the convention, but from what I've read is that you had, as the convention would go through each round of the vote, if you finished last, you were no longer on the ballot for the next round of the vote. And there were some, internal battles going on. When Secretary of State Matt Schultz finished 5th or finished last on the ballot, he pledged his support to David Young and asked his supporters to vote for him. There was a sense that, if I remember right, that David Young won, I believe, 10 counties, or the delegates from 10 counties, and then was able to split the delegate vote in Polk County, which sort of offset the lead that Brad Zahn had built up in Polk County, being from the Urbandale area. So a lot of it was just part of the convention and different candidates dropping out and delegates kind of gradually moving forward toward David Young. That's the unique thing about a convention, and, it'll be interesting to see if anything comes of it, whether or not Iowa actually thinks about moving away from a convention ballot to just a simple runoff election, mm-hmm. like we saw in Mississippi. I mean, that seems to be where most states are, is just having a simple runoff election.
Well, that might be a good question for our listeners. Should these races go to convention or be decided by a runoff? Let's hear from you, River to River listeners, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, we're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. So we had in the June 3rd primary, Brad Zahn, Matt Schultz, Robert Kramer, Monty Shaw, all finishing ahead of David Young. He gets the tip, though. What do you think Tim Hagel delegates saw in him that made them want him as a nominee?
Well, again, it's as Chris was saying, it's a function of how the vote was taking place. And again, if you had sort of a runoff kind of type situation, even if it was held in the convention, that he probably wouldn't have done as well. But the way the convention worked is that they would have a ballot, and they didn't drop anybody off the ballot in the first round. So then they have a second round ballot, and Grand Danette was the one to drop off with, I think he had all of 7 delegate votes at that point. So this didn't really affect it much. But then in the next round of voting is where you started to see okay, I think it was Kramer that was the one that was dropped off. And so he didn't, I don't think, endorse anyone. And then, as Chris said, when Schultz was knocked off, that he did endorse. And so you see, well, who's the sort of the closest? And what people were saying was that Young was a lot of people's second choice. And that's what some people had been talking about, and if I was following all this on Twitter, and talking about that maybe they came to the convention and they were sure who they wanted to vote for their first choice, but the key was who was their second choice. And at least for the people that got dropped off in the third and fourth rounds, it seemed that their second choice was Young. Plus, Zahn's support in Polk County was not as strong as a lot of people thought that he was, and eventually he only got about half the votes in Polk County. I think some people apparently believed that he would not be the strongest general election candidate, and ultimately Young was the last one left.
Bill is joining us from Ames. Hi, Bill. You've been listening to our conversation. What do you want to chip in?
Yeah, I really enjoy the idea of the convention. I think it gets back to getting the party behind someone rather than just saying who's going to be the most electable. Sometimes the most electable isn't the most important thing because it allows people to grow throughout the campaign and really take a stance and make things better.
Mm-hmm. You're in Iowa's 4th district, not in the 3rd, but you think we should stick with a convention approach. So, Chris Larimer, there are trade-offs.
There are trade-offs, but again, you know, if you think about it, some people are upset with the idea of 700-800 people at a convention deciding who the candidate is going to be, rather than the sort of a district-wide vote where you have you allow more people to participate in the process.
Mm-hmm. And let's go to Bob quickly before we have to take a break. Bob in Iowa City has something to say on this point as well.
Good morning. It almost makes a farce of the election, frankly. Why even bother with an election? Let's just have this convention decide who the candidates are going to be all the time.
Makes a farce of the primary election is what you mean, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does. The voice of the people indicated two of them were extremely popular, and let's have a runoff for those two, not just have 500 people pick who the candidates are.
Okay. Bob, thanks for your opinion. Bob and Bill voicing differing opinions there on this politics day. We're going to take a short break. Thanks, Bob, for calling from Iowa City. When we come back, we'll talk more about the congressional races here in Iowa now that the matchups are set. We hope you'll join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. What do you think about? Should we have a runoff instead of deciding by convention? 1-866-780-9100. Also, what issues matter to you most in choosing who wins your vote in the general election? Tim Hagel is with us of the University of Iowa. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. When we come back, we'll talk about that race for the open Senate seat here in Iowa. Stay tuned. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So happy to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, where he's Associate Professor of Political Science, and Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, in our Iowa City studio, chewing over the results of the final last chapter multi-state primaries that took place yesterday. Not in Iowa, across the country, but we're also bearing down, focusing on the congressional races here in Iowa. Now that all of the slots have been taken, for sure, with now the third district in place, and asking our listeners when a primary is too close to call, should the nominee be decided by a convention, as it was in the 3rd District, or by a runoff vote? 1-866-780-9100. Got a couple more people to talk about that before we move on to talking about our Senate race. Let's talk to Charlotte in Ames. Hi, Charlotte. Where do you fall on this question?
Hi. Well, I lived in Georgia for 30 years. They have primary runoffs there, and it actually, the elections work really well. You have the same opportunity to recruit people that didn't vote in the election at all, like Tad Cochran has done down in Mississippi. And you have the same opportunity to get your people out to vote that you do at a general election. And then you're not subject to questions about whether undue influence was brought to bear by party fanatics. Mm-hmm. Because if they went to the polls, then they represented their district.
Right. Charlotte, thanks for your view from Ames. Let's move over to Des Moines. Chris, what's your view on this question?
Well, I like to quote, I can't remember what famous lady said it, but if voting mattered, they'd make it illegal. And I was on the Republican Central Committee, and I'm sure it's like it with a Democratic one, but it's just a farce. It's just a big show. And I just think at this point, where it's the year 2014, and I don't think we really need leaders anymore. We just need an enforcement side that enforces laws, and I think we all need to not vote and disobey bad laws, not comply.
Wow.
I just think young people are getting the short end of it, and I think they need to just not vote because it really doesn't matter. These people will do what they want. Doesn't matter what the law. They even break the law.
Okay.
So I just think that it's time for people just to stand up and say no more. I'm not going to give you a mandate to take money from me to do things that's not in my interest, no matter what you say on the campaign trail and what you promise.
Okay, there's a view that's not middle of the road. Thank you for that, Chris in Des Moines. Chris in Cedar Falls, or Tim, any reaction to either of those callers?
As last caller was thinking, I remember some shirt years ago that said, don't vote, it only encourages them.
Nice.
Okay. Well, what about changing the system? We're likely we have the system we have, and are there any signs that it will change?
I haven't seen any signs that it'll change, but, you know, people seem to value the idea of maximum participation, that if you have it open to a runoff, that more people can participate. I mean, the other side of it is, yeah, we have elections, we have midterm elections, we have primary elections, and not many people take advantage of them. If you're talking about 10, 15, 20, 25% of registered voters turning out to vote, then maybe a runoff election is not the way to go if you really want to maximize participation, because not that many people are participating.
Okay. Let's look at this open Senate race that will be interesting for weeks to come up until the November election. Democrat U.S. Representative Bruce Braley leads Republican State Senator Joni Ernst 44% to 40% in Iowa's U.S. Senate race. That's the most recent poll released a few days ago by the Quinnipiac University. Ernst, though, closing the gap, Braley led with 42 to 29%. That was back in a March 13th survey. What's going on here with the closing of the gap, Tim Hagel? What do you see?
Well, a couple of things. The first, of course, is that from the double-digit lead that Braley had in March or something like that, that's about the time, as we're closing in on the primary, when Ernst sort of made the big splash. And, of course, because of her very strong primary win, she got a primary bounce, and so she was up a little bit and was going to – not surprising that it was going to fall back a little bit. And so now we've seen where it seems to have settled. We'll have to wait and see what future polls suggest. But it basically means that it's going to be a tougher race than what a lot of people initially thought.
When we look at these numbers a little closer, there's an unusual gender gap here. Chris, more female registered voters supporting the man, while more men supporting the woman. Women backing Braley 47% to 36%, while men backing Ernst 44% to 40%. What do you see here?
Well, I want to be careful on this, particularly if Diane Bystrom at Iowa State is listening, because she has been upset with the way that some of these numbers have been interpreted as far as the gender gap. And when you're looking at that, you have to look at it, the difference between men and women for a single candidate. So in this case, women prefer Congressman Braley by 7 percentage points, while men prefer Joni Ernst by 8 percentage points, which is actually quite typical, that women tend to gravitate more toward the Democratic candidate and men more toward the Republican candidate. So I don't see a lot of difference there from what we've seen in previous polls.
Okay.
I think going forward with the race, the challenge for Braley is going to be to distance himself from President Obama. We've seen in other polls that Quinnipiac has just released that Obama's approval rating is now, you know, 40%, if not less than 40%. A lot of the research in political science will tell you that for a senatorial election, presidential approval matters and presidential popularity matters. So in this case, Congressman Braley shares party affiliation with President Obama, a very unpopular president. And I think for Congressman Braley, the challenge going forward is, how does he separate himself from the Democratic Party, or at least separate himself from President Obama? Does he need to actually come out with ads that say, here are cases where I've actually voted against President Obama, given his unpopularity in the state?
You see it the same way, Tim Hagel?
I do. Let me go back to the first part of what Chris was talking about, rather than getting into sort of the policy side of things. And that is, as Chris mentioned, the idea that women generally tend to support the Democrat. And part of that has to do with there are just many more women that are Democrats than Republicans. And so you've got sort of a built-in gender gap there. The other thing, and I didn't see this when I tried to look at that particular poll, is sort of what was the party breakdown, how many Republicans, Democrats, no party voters, how many men, how many women. And at least what I looked at, the poll was just showing percentages, not actual numbers. And that breakdown for midterm election is very important, that Republicans and Democrats do tend to vote very well. Republicans may be a higher, slightly higher percentage turnout. The no party voters, they're the most numerous in terms of registered voters, but they also have the lowest turnout percentage. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in midterm elections, it's down around 25-30%. And so it's very important to what sort of distribution that those polls have as to what meaning we can draw from them.
What about this question that Chris raised about the Braley's chief concern here is distancing himself from the Obama administration?
Well, yeah, I would agree with Chris on that point, that especially when you're talking a statewide election, and that's what we were talking before in the first half about how all politics is local, but when you expand it out to the state level, then it sort of dilutes that local aspect a little bit. And certainly Republicans are going to try very hard to make that an issue, and they already have been pointing out that Congressman Braley was the last person to speak on behalf of Obamacare before it voted and so forth, and certainly they've been touting, they being Democrats in general, have been touting the advantages, people getting signed up and so forth, and complaining about calls to repeal it entirely. And so you're going to have to get into the nitty gritty. And so that's probably going to be an issue during the entire campaign.
Okay.
And I wonder if I could add to that quickly. And, you know, with all the caveats that Tim mentioned about the polls and the numbers within the polls, in one of the polls, it had Obama at 26 percentage points under for independents. So if we assume that independents are the no party voters in the state, they disapprove of Obama by a 59-33% margin. And so, again, if no party voters, they may not vote at a very high rate, but if we have a competitive election this midterm, again, for Braley, you know, appealing to those no party voters is going to mean sort of distance from the president.
Well, what's more of Braley's strategy here? Joni Ernst, with that huge primary victory, avoided a runoff, avoided anything in the convention, highlighting getting national attention for her ability to shoot guns and castrate hogs, we have to say, overcoming a very sleepy primary election there. What is Braley's strategy here? How does he want to paint her, Tim?
Well, right out of the gate that they have and certainly had plenty of time to do opposition research, and so they – and this is true from any campaign – that you want to try to define your candidate, and especially one that's coming out of a – maybe it was a sleepy primary race, but it was one where there wasn't a lot of money spent, a lot – kind of low-key, maybe a lot of people
– Until that first Joni Ernst
ad hit. Until that first Joni Ernst, and she sort of shot to the front of the pack. And in that sense, it gives the Democrats an opportunity to try to define her, especially if she doesn't have a lot of money coming out of the primary, has to build up some resources. And so they were ready with opposition research and define her, trying to connect her with the Koch brothers, anti-Iowa values is, I think, one of the themes that they had been indicating. And so basically try to define her in negative terms, and where the Ernst campaign is trying to come back and say, oh, no, here are my values. Here's what I stand on the issues. And, of course, they're doing the negative thing against Braley, too, the Washington connecting him to Obamacare and so forth. So we're going to see a lot of this in the next 4 months.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Tim, because we have an example of an ad that's out there that is going against Joni Ernst here. We certainly heard plenty of ads, saw plenty of ads of Joni Ernst out there that went viral and received a lot of attention, not only in here in Iowa, but nationwide. Here's a new ad that's not as complimentary to Joni Ernst. Let's listen to this ad paid for by the League of Conservation Voters.
Hiring her, expecting her to fulfill campaign promises.
Joni Ernst promises shut down the Department of Education, hurting Iowa students. Abolish the EPA, giving polluters a pass. That's why extremist Sarah Palin and the billionaire Koch brothers want Ernst in Washington.
Hiring her, expecting her to fulfill campaign.
Joni Ernst. Promises to them, too extreme for us. The League of Conservation Voters is responsible for the content of this advertising.
What about that, Chris Larimer? Tying Joni Ernst to the Koch brothers, to Sarah Palin, a good tactic?
I think in part, you know, as this race move forward, as this race moves forward, we're getting the sense that on the ballot in November, it's just going to be an oval for Obamacare and an oval for Sarah Palin rather than Bruce Braley
or Koch brothers.
Right? Yeah, exactly. I think you know, in this case, you know, trying to paint Joni Ernst as extreme is sort of an appeal to moderate voters to say that she is too extreme for Iowa. It's perhaps maybe an appeal to independent or no party voters in the state. Talking about the regulation of the environment, you know, that's an issue where independents come down somewhat closer to Democrats than Republicans, though that depends a little bit on how you frame the question, whether you're talking about environmental protection, energy issues, or global warming. So I think in this case, it's just trying to paint her as too extreme for more moderate voters in the state.
One thing that struck me about this is that it seemed like and we always see the negative advertising and everybody says, oh, we don't like it, but everybody knows that it works to a certain extent. But sometimes it can backfire. And one of the things that surprised me was that it was so negative so quickly. And I kind of wondered, well, who's paying attention at this point? And one aspect of this may be to help fire up the base, because Democrats have talked before about how they're worried that they don't – I think President Obama phrased it as, we don't vote in midterm elections. Well, I don't think that's necessarily true, but certainly they have to try to make sure that the drop-off from the presidential year to the midterm year is as small as possible for their party. And, of course, Republicans are trying to do the same thing. And so there's a certain aspect of firing it up, and I'm not sure that a lot of the no-party voters, and again, those are the folks, again, maybe a low turnout, but they're the ones that decide the elections for the most part, that they're paying close attention at this point, at least on average, compared to Republicans and Democrats. And so it may be that this is an opportunity to try to fire up the base. We'll have to see how the campaign develops. But there's always that danger that if you go too negative too fast, that it could hurt you in the long run. And that was one of the things that hurt. We talked before about the Eric Cantor race in Virginia, and that was one of the things that some say hurt him.
Tim Hagel with us, along with Chris Larimer, Politics Wednesday, finishing up the hour. I want to get to a couple of other items before our hour does get away from us. We don't pay attention a lot to the 4th District in Iowa, there in the northwest corner. Also now it's stretching down, and since redistricting to include Ames, I was interested to see alarm bells ringing out in the Iowa Republican, an online article put out by the Iowa Republican. Federal race in Iowa that has received the least amount of attention from Republicans and the media, the 4th District. There, conservative firebrand Steve King facing a relatively unknown, completely unknown challenger for many, Democrat Jim Maurer. Can you tell us a little bit about this race, Tim Hagel?
Well, as you said, it's kind of a seemingly a sleepy race, and certainly you mentioned the alarm bells, and that's one of the things that, regardless of party, even in most seemingly safe seats, you can't always take it for granted.
And let me give a little background to that alarm bells that was in this Iowa Republican article. Earlier this month, the National Democrats added Maurer, this political newcomer, to their Red to Blue program. It provides a mix of financial and other assistance to some of the most promising challengers in the Democrats' eyes. He's been steadily out fundraising. Steve King holds a better than 2-to-1 cash in the hand advantage over the incumbent. Chris, what is your view on the 4th District race now? Is there a chance to unseat Steve King?
I would say it's a pretty small chance. You know, to me, the 4th District is a bit of an outlier when you look at it compared to the other three. You know, the 1st and 2nd congressional districts in the eastern part of the state, they lean Democratic by 5-6 percentage points, but there's a big no-party element in both. Both districts have 2 or 3 counties that where you see an enormous part of the vote share. You move over to the 3rd District, you know, that's a very competitive district in terms of registered Democrats, registered Republicans. And again, you have a couple of swing counties in Pottawatomie and Polk County. But then you go up to the 4th District, you have a case where I think Republicans outnumber Democrats in terms of registered voters by about 11 percentage points. You were talking about a midterm election where we generally see a higher Republican turnout. And in this case, we have a Republican incumbent running. So to me, it's a bit surprising that the Democratic Party would put this as a red to blue district.
But when we look at what Steve King faced in the last election, this couldn't be more different. We have an unknown candidate, Jim Maurer, here. We had the best known candidate that you could imagine, former First Lady Kristi Vilsack last time. So
And that was during a presidential election where Democratic turnout is presumably higher. So I think, you know, I think a lot of things are going in Steve King's favor at this point, even if the fundraising is not yet I would be very surprised if he does not come out on top in November.
But Tim Hagel, couldn't the blank slate that is Jim Maurer in this case, in this political field, be an advantage for him?
Well, it's always that glass half empty, half full kind of thing that you can say, well, a lot of people don't know him. That means he has an opportunity to appeal to those people. But on the other hand, that's a lot of work and people will know Steve King and already have an opinion, many people positive, many people negative. But he doesn't have to do that same amount of work. And so some of the money that Maurer has raised certainly got to go to that, getting out his name recognition, upping that and so forth. But one of the reasons that the Democrats would maybe try to put a little bit more emphasis on this seat is that he has apparently done the kinds of things that they expect a candidate, a significant candidate, a serious candidate to do in terms of the fundraising and I assume the door knocking and other sorts of phone calls.
Has a military background.
And the military background is something that is appealing, will help to appeal to more people, veterans, of course, and others supporting the military. He can speak authoritatively on those issues. And it's the kind of a thing well, maybe they don't think he's actually going to win, but if he can draw enough attention that it forces King to stay home, so to speak, and pay more attention where he can't be out helping other candidates and maybe has to make sure he spends any money he raises in his own race rather than helping other people. And so sometimes that's the goal rather than necessarily an outright victory.
Finally, we learned recently that Monica Vernon will be Jack Hatch's running mate on the Democratic ticket for Iowa governor as candidate for lieutenant governor, a Cedar Rapids councilwoman, a business owner, a native of eastern Iowa, we can say, and a seasoned campaigner. Why did Hatch choose Vernon in your view, Chris?
Well, I think, you know, Vernon is certainly a safe choice. It's someone that voters in the first congressional district primary were certainly excited about, even if she did not get to the 35% that Pat Murphy did in that district. You know, with a business background, I think that's generally appealing to Democratic voters or voters or an election in which you're trying to reach a broader base of voters as you would in a midterm election. And, you know, it's someone who has been out on the campaign trail, who has been in the news recently. She does have name recognition, and she has name recognition, in a county where that's extremely important for a statewide vote. I mean, in Iowa, we have six or seven counties where there's a big portion of the vote share, and you're talking about Linn County and good connections in Linn County. You know, I think it makes sense.
Does that really change someone's mind if the lieutenant governor comes from your county? Is that a vote getter?
Well, I think you're more familiar with the candidate, and in the case of Jack Hatch, what we've seen in polls is that he is not known that well among a lot of voters in the state of Iowa, so he needed someone else who could kind of ramp up enthusiasm for that ticket.
A poll conducted mid-June finds not much change since March in the race for the governor. Branstad's lead over Jack Hatch in a Quinnipiac poll, 9% compared to the 11% lead in March. Really statistically not very significant. Going forward here, what does Hatch have to do to make this a close race, Tim Hagel?
A lot of work. Again, he's going to have to make sure that he gets his name recognition up. People know who he is and so forth. And it's basically the same what I was saying before as far as Maurer, that maybe a lot of people don't know who he is. So he's got to reach out to those people, let them know where he stands on a variety of issues. And, of course, he's got Vernon to help him with that as well as other staffers and so forth. But he's got to get out there and make his case as to why he thinks that he would be a better governor than Branstad. And so there will be certain issues, whether it's the scandals, if we want to use that word, for the Branstad administration in various ways, try to make that an issue, so like an ethics kind of a thing. They'll also try to make the issue that he's been in for a very long time. But on the other hand, the Branstad campaign has been touting its successes, improved jobs, better economy, better state budget. So, you know, there's going to see a lot of back and forth on those types of issues.
Last word to you, Chris. Any final thoughts?
Well, yeah, I think part of the Hatch challenge is just giving voters a reason to vote against Branstad. You know, his approval ratings have been trending upward, and, you know, he has a lot of factors going his way in terms of economic factors. But even if people don't think he deserves reelection, there hasn't been a strong case made to vote against him.
Chris Larimer, Tim Hagel, thanks for chewing over politics with us on this Politics Wednesday here on River to River. We appreciate it. Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Chris, Tim, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk with a few nuns who have spent their lives trying to make a difference as activists. I'll talk with Sister Simone Campbell, one of the nuns on the bus. Perhaps you've heard of them. Her bus tour came through Iowa in 2012. Now she's written a memoir. We'll talk with her tomorrow on this program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. Help today from Julie Englander. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks so much for joining us.